Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Infinite Worlds podcast. I'm your host, Winston Ward, publisher of Infinite Worlds magazine. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Nick the Tooth.
Dude, we are here. I cannot believe this day has finally come. It feels like I've been waiting for this forever.
What's great is we've been doing the podcast for years now, and what was the first thing we were talking about? Obviously, our first episode was about Star Wars, but we were talking about Dune the whole time. And then our second episode was about Dune. And really, Dune has been one of the biggest influences for both of us and one of the most often referenced science fiction stories. This started before the movies were announced. And now here we are, finally basking in the beautiful glory of this two-part film now completed. How are you feeling about it?
I'm freaking out. I feel like I'm about to, I kind of wish we were recording video because I feel like I'd be like the greatest nemesis, the real life Baron Harkonnen, Alex Jones. I feel like I'd be freaking out like him talking about this thing, man, right? You never heard that, have you? You never thought that heard it.
Alex Jones actually listens to our podcast, and right now he's laying in a big tub of oil just going, hey!
Oh my God. Yeah. So we're here to talk about Dune 2, and you know, it's
Dune 2.
Listen, this pent up feelings about Dune are warranted because this was supposed to drop in October, right? Late because of the actor strike, and I was like, oh my gosh, it's never gonna happen. And finally it did, and I got to see it Sunday. Oh my gosh, I am so happy. I was so happy. Oh,
I take it that you're giving it a positive review then.
I lost my mind. It was just for me, I lost my mind. Yeah.
You know, this is crazy. I just went and looked back at all this. We did Dune 2021. That film came out in 2021, and now it's 2024.
Wow.
So it's been 2.5 years since the first one came out. 2.5 years. And it doesn't seem like that long ago, really, at all to me. But when it came out, we both gave our reviews, and my review and the way I felt about the movie just until a couple of days ago when I watched the sequel was reserved. Like, I gave it a reserved review. I liked it. I did like it. But it didn't quite carry me away the way I hoped it would. And now I know why. Now I know why. Because the second film, as my friend Jeff Wooten, a good buddy of mine, put this when I talked to him about it, is the second film not only is just a smashing success, it elevates the first film. So as taken as a pair, now the first film becomes that much better to me.
I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. Where I was like, this makes, because I felt the same way, where I felt in the first film, I was like, this is amazing, but it felt lacking, which it should have because it was a two-parter.
Right.
Right? It was like, right, we're going to break the story into two. And, you know, like any great story, you know, it ratchets up the intensity until at the end, you're just like, oh my gosh. And it did it. He's a master filmmaker and he did it.
Yeah, At this point, I have to agree. He's a master filmmaker. And I couldn't agree more at this point. And before I was like, man, because I love Blade Runner 2049. And Arrival is incredible. He's a great filmmaker and I like his movies a lot. But with the first one, I was like, oh man, he didn't quite reach the pinnacle that I hoped he would. We're talking about Denis Villeneuve here, the director of Dune and all of these films. But now, seeing that he just needed the second film to do it, to have the set in order to get there, it's so fulfilling. I think that's the word that I want to use to describe this movie, is fulfilling, because it fulfills my expectations and my hopes of what a Dune movie could be. And, you know, it fulfills the prophecy of the Quetzalcoatl, obviously.
Yeah, it was... There were very few critiques I had for the movie. Very, very few. And, you know, it's interesting that you talk about Star Wars, because I did have, as I was, I'm in Miami now, and as I was walking home from the theater, I was thinking about it through the neighborhood, and I was just thinking about how it made Star Wars for the first time. I love David Lynch's version, but it doesn't compare to this.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, because that first Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, but especially the first Star Wars, was masterful, you know, filmmaking. And I didn't, although I love David Lynch's version, it's just kind of a mess.
It is, yeah.
And this was the first, this was, and there have been like very other adaptations of Dune novels. And they were just kind of like, This one made me really reflect on just kind of what a secondhand ripoff that Star Wars was of Dune. I didn't, you know what? I mean, I'm serious.
Yeah.
I'm serious where you're just like, wow, this is Dune is the adult version. Dune is what I always hoped that Star Wars, as I got older, would be. And it kind of was with Rogue One. But Dune is what I want.
Right.
And I finally got it.
Look, Star Wars is a lot of fun. It is. And there's parts of Star Wars, and like you said, some whole films that are masterful and that reach that level, that transcend popcorn film. And they definitely do it. But just as a whole, they don't. You know, Star Wars as a whole carries the aftertaste of kids' film. And don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. At all. I mean, I love so many movies. We've talked about so many movies that describes Back to the Future and so many
others. Yeah.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But when you want that piece of art, you know, when you want that masterpiece, you don't want to have it pander to the lowest common denominator in any way. You don't want it to be lowbrow at any point. That's not necessarily true of any film at all. And there can be pandering and that transcendence achieved, but only when it's natural and not shoehorned in. You know, when you see like, oh, the comic relief that studio insisted that there be. But when you just tell a story in a pure way without, you know, shoehorning any of that stuff in, then you get what the critical person wants in a movie. People like you and I. And I can imagine the vast majority of our listeners.
I would think so. I would think so. I haven't really looked at critical reviews like Rotten Tomatoes, but I would.
They're through the roof, just so you know, critically speaking. And I'm surprised, honestly. I'm surprised that it wasn't panned more, not because it deserves to be panned more, but because critics like to pan this type of movie.
Yeah.
Any sort of sci-fi, futuristic action movie of any kind is going to get panned. But it didn't at all. Right now, I've actually got these tabs open. Right now, Dune 2 is on Rotten Tomatoes is sitting at a 93% critic score.
Wow.
Which, that's insane for Rotten Tomatoes. And a 95% audience score. So it's got an A and an A+, according to the critics and the audiences, which is, I mean, phenomenal. I mean, if you ever keep up with the scores of movies on Rotten Tomatoes, you know how good that is. Right now on IMDb, it's got an 8.9, which is absurd on IMDb. That puts it in the top like 25 movies ever made. Of course, it's a new movie. So let's temper that by understanding that new movies, when they're reviewed, don't have the test of time added to their score. That is to say, as time goes on, reviews could worsen. Audiences still get to vote on the movie next year and the year after and the year after and so on. And they later on, it might not age that well and the score might go down. I'm having trouble imagining that, but it might.
Yeah, I can't imagine either. But, you know, it was just so good. Just so good. And, it, you know, what was awesome about it, I remember, like, looking at my watch at, like, 2 hours and 20 minutes or whatever it was. And I was like, I am still so enthralled by this movie. I could not believe how the action scenes were unbelievable. The battles.
The action scenes were unbelievable. And I am never a person who is ever impressed by action scenes, ever. Yeah. I never watch a movie and think, wow, the action scenes in that are so great. Almost never. Neither. But this movie had incredible action scenes and music cues and just sound editing and the visual effects. The technical side of this movie is as close to flawless as a movie can be. in my opinion, in the terms of the technical side of the movie. All of the editing, sound editing, costume design, all that kind of stuff was just 10 out of 10 across the board, in my opinion. I guess it'll be easier for this episode if we try to think of things we didn't like about it instead of just naming it all the things. It'll be a much shorter list.
The number one complaint that I had is I so wanted to see a guild navigator.
Yeah, didn't happen.
They were featured up front in David Lynch's version. And for me, guild navigators are like one of the coolest things.
Yeah, they really didn't talk about guild navigation much at all over the course of this two-parter.
No, but they showed the guild navigators. I don't know if you caught that. That's where, this is my interpretation, is they were showing the guild navigators. Wasn't it with Raban was with the guild navigators when they were trying to find where the Fremen were in the south? And I don't think so.
I think that was just some Harkonnen or perhaps some officials of Arrakis from like some sort of provisional local government, that kind of thing. That was my intake on that.
Yeah, see, the only reason I thought that they were the guild navigators, and that's why I was like, I don't know, not the navigators, but that was the guild, the space guild, spacing guild.
The spacing. Oh, it could have been, you know, not the navigators, but just a different branch of the spacing guild.
Yeah, but
okay. Well, then
because
that's
they were handling the satellite, you know, monitoring over.
Oh, you're right. You're right about that.
Yeah, but the only thing that didn't make sense is he killed one of them. And there's no way that he would.
Well, maybe the lower level guild, the navigators might treat their like henchmen the way the Harkonnens treat.
Yeah, so
henchmen.
You've got the spacing guild, and only one part of the spacing guild are the guild navigators. And there aren't.
Right,
there aren't,
right. And they're way more powerful
way more
than
powerful
everybody else in the guild.
Very rare. Now, when the first movie, we did see the spacing guild, we saw representatives from them emperors, when that Imperium ship landed on Atreides or on
Arrakis?
Yeah, no.
Or no, you mean on
Caladan.
Caladan?
Yeah. So they landed on Caladan and they were meeting with the Duke and they opened up the ship and they came out and they had the big helmets with the
right, large... right. Yeah, that was one of the promo images before the first movie came out.
Oh, so amazing. Now, they were from the guild, okay, the Space Guild. So I don't know, but we never saw a navigator. But I will say this, there are no navigators described in Dune. They're not described.
Yeah, they don't describe their physical form, only that they're mutated.
And I didn't even think they described that they're mutated. It's very, very in the first book. And that's all this is the first book. They go into the description in, I think it's Dune Messiah or Children of Dune, something like one of those books opens with a description of a navigator. So I do get why he didn't go there. But I guess I had so much anticipation because of the David Lynch.
Right.
Dip. Other than that, that was it. And if they were the guild, I had a hard time with Raban because of the power of the Spacing Guild. Now, the Spacing Guild is so powerful because you're not traveling without them.
Right.
They have enormous power in the Empire. So that was it. Anyways, that was kind of like my only thing. How about you? Any critiques?
I approach movies, I approach stories when I hear them in probably an unhealthy way, I think. Because when I hear a story, I try my best to think of things I don't like about, to think of things that are illogical, to take me out of the story. Then once I've got that list of all of the things that I don't like in my head, I weigh that against the list of things that I do like about the movie, then I, you know, form my opinion that way. But it's really important for me to organize my thoughts about things I don't like. But I found that really difficult to do with this movie. That, to me, says you must have really liked that movie. Okay, so my minor things, even though I love him more than almost anyone, I do think Christopher Walken was miscast. Mm-hmm. Or at least, maybe not miscast. That might be a little harsh to say he was miscast or whatever, but I don't think he was necessary for the movie, I guess is what I mean. We didn't need Christopher Walken's personality in the movie on top of all of the other stuff we saw. By the same exact thing, I don't think it was necessary to have the cameo of Anya Taylor-Joy either as the vision of the grown Alia.
Yeah.
The way they handled that was a little weird for me. I didn't hate it. I just didn't love it.
I loved the young Alia in Dune.
Oh, yeah.
I was kind of bummed about that, too.
Young Alia in David Lynch's Dune is, like, possibly the best part of the whole
thing. Oh, so rad.
So rad and creepy and just genuinely weird, and I just love it. So that was a little bit different. The fact that they really glossed over the whole Space and Guild thing, you're right, that was a kind of a shame because that is a really great part of the Dune story. I guess something's gonna have to hit the edit room floor, though. You know what I mean? The two movies were already almost 6 hours.
Not only that, it's a movie, and so, you know, when you have a dramatic through line that is like, okay, here is the plot. Movies are very plot-driven, where novels, they don't necessarily adhere to that through line. So I think that it was like, listen, these are our main characters who have this conflict that must be resolved. And anything that detracts from that is really sloppy filmmaking. I get that. It's a movie. It's not a book.
Right.
I get it. Right. I mean, I'm happy about it.
Speaking to that point, we should talk about some of the things I've heard about this film. Like Denis Villeneuve, he says of himself that he is a very harsh editor and that he kills his thematic darlings. He kills his storytelling darlings without mercy. And he's also a big believer that if once something hits the edit room floor, that it's dead forever. He'll never put deleted scenes in anything in any of his movies.
Wow.
Which is a real shame because there were some other, like Tim Blake Nelson was in this movie. One of my favorite actors in the world was in this movie and his character got cut.
Whoa, what's his character?
Count Henrig. And apparently he had more than one scene and it got cut. His whole character got cut.
Yeah, because he was the wife of Lady Fenrig and who hooked up with and was manipulating Fade.
Right.
And clearly had sex with him and then was carrying that bloodline.
She even said it. She was like, the bloodline is secured.
Is secured, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that character, her husband.
Yes, he was in the book pretty extensively.
But yeah, he's a big-time editor and cuts all of these things out. And because of that, there are certain things we're never going to get to see.
Let me tell you, one thing that I thought I wasn't going to like in the promos is I cannot stand when they go to black and white. So I thought it would be a flashback. I can't stand when they do that, but it wasn't. And so when they explained it, I guess there was like a third sun on their planet. And when that rose, it just made everything like almost infrared or something. It had some kind of a radioactive light that made everything just like washed out all the colors. And so I thought that actually worked. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. It's only when they're outside, when that third sun has risen, is what I got out of it, that it's like that. So that was kind of cool. And that was during the whole Bade gladiator scene. Was there anything else that you heard that they cut?
So Stephen McKinley Henderson, who's in the first film as Thufir Hawat, was in the second film as well.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, Thufir was in the second film, but his parts got cut, along with Tim Blake Nelson's. And the character's name is Hassimer Fenring. Count Hassimer Fenring. I was like, he's got the weirdest name, but I could not remember it. Hassimer Fenring, that's Tim Blake Nelson's character, the husband of the Bene Gesserit who seduces Fade. Okay, so speaking of Fade, I went in very dubious of Austin Matthews' ability to pull off Fade. I was so wrong.
Oh,
I was way off with that one, man. He was great.
Yeah.
He was so creepy and scary, and he brought real life to that character, and I loved it.
Yeah.
They even added a whole lengthy scene just for Fade to develop his character with the whole arena birthday fight.
Yeah. Because
that doesn't happen in the novel, does it? I don't remember that.
Oh, it does. There's a gladiator scene in the novel.
There
also.
Is?
Yeah.
With Fade?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I'm going to have to go back and read that because I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, it's wild, right? Because I don't think we realize how influenced we are by the David Lynch version.
The thing is that I read the book in preparation for our Dune episode, and then I've read it since then, too. It's weird that I can't remember the scene, but that's, like you said, the influence of the films.
I think it might be chapter 36 or something like that.
Okay. I do remember the scene now. You know what it is? I thought of this happening in a small setting with him fighting one soldier for the amusement of the Baron, not this big thing that it was on his birthday and all that. In the book, he cheats.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember this. Okay. So what they did was they just made it a lot different than it happens in the book. Okay. Okay. Now I see. Now I remember what happens. In the book, he is a cheater. In the movie, he basically does the opposite of that. He throws away his advantage.
Well, he gets set up by his uncle.
Right. And still throws away his advantage, even though
yeah.
he realizes that he's set up. He still like turns off his shield.
Yeah.
It throws his shield away and then fights that guy and wins. You know, that's where my confusion lies, is that the scene plays out very, very, very differently in the movie than it does in the book. Okay. So thank you for being patient while I put the pieces together in my mind there. But yeah, even though that is different than it was in the novel, it's still a really cool scene.
Yeah.
And he's excellent in it. Thought overall, him as a character was great.
I liked him more than I thought I was gonna like him. I was like, Austin Butler, you know, he's pretty cool, but is he gonna pull this off? Why is he bald? But man, it really...
Yeah, the scene where he's murdering the women in front of his like weird, extremely weird concubine was very creepy and unsettling, and just talking about like the weight of the knife as he's using it to just murder the women that are his helpers. It was just like, Jesus, this is a unhinged dude. You know, of course, having seen all of the horror and sci-fi movies that I've seen, it's hard to shock me. So I wasn't exactly shocked, but they did. It was still good character building. So he was excellent.
Oh, the depravity of...
Yeah.
The depravity of the Harkonnens, I don't know if we got it to the extent, obviously, that David Lynch, you know, really showed it. And the way the latter books, like House Harkonnen, really went into it, where it was like, oh my gosh. But, you know, but still, it was, you definitely came away where you were especially with the Baron, where it was like, oh my God. I thought he was.
Oh, absolutely. Stellan Skarsgård kills it as the Baron. He's the best Baron by a mile. No offense to the actor who played the Baron in the David Lynch Dune, whose name I cannot remember. I apologize. He was great, you know, way over the top and kind of like clownish and buffoonish. But Stellan Skarsgård as the Baron was awesome.
Oh, he was perfect.
He really was.
And what was wild is that I read that he had the opportunity to just use CGI and he used all practical effects. He was like, no. I'm going to go through the 10 hours or whatever.
8 hours a day and 2 hours to remove every day. And he didn't drink anything. And he took Imodium pills so he would never have to go to the bathroom after he got his costume on shooting days. Which is why there's a somewhat limited amount of the Baron in the movie. You know, that's going to be really taxing on any actor. And Stellan's got to be, what, 65 or something like that?
Yeah.
You know, so that's going to be tough.
So one of the things that I loved about the book, and I had never encountered this really in a sci-fi book or any book, I don't even know if I've encountered it since then, but what really blew me away was how in Dune the book, he really hit home the theme of how mythology and religious mythology is used to manipulate people.
Oh, yeah.
And to manipulate massive populations of people. And I don't think on reflection that David Lynch's Dune really hit that hard. I don't really remember it.
No, it did not.
But in this movie, he killed it because it was like at least it felt like 10 scenes, but, you know, 4 or 5 scenes of where you had this ratcheting up of this tension between Paul and his mother, where she was like, I'm going to go south and I'm going to manipulate and amplify this message that you are the Messiah so that we can have this strength of the Fremen. And so there was that tension the whole time, even from the first movie. And it really got played out here. In fact, it was one of the big plot points.
One of my favorite things about this movie was how they actually took that theme of the novel and really showcased it. I couldn't agree more. The way the Fremen were presented in this movie, they were like an Arabic tribe, but like they were an Arabic people, which is what they were modeled after in the novel.
Exactly.
So it actually brought about that Abrahamic, Arabic, Islam, Christian, Jewish cultural diaspora that is resulting in most of the major conflict on Earth right now. And it basically put a mirror to that and really hammered home the analogy that in the book that they were forming about the exploitation of oil specifically, but of resources and using religion as a way to leverage populations in order to gain control over resources.
I mean, we saw in our lifetime, after the millennium, George W. Bush did the exact same thing.
Oh, yes.
For
oh, yes.
rallying the American people to go invade friggin' Iraq.
It's happening again right now in the Middle East. You know what I mean? The land grabbing in the name of religion and resource grabbing in the name of religion is really what the book is warning you about. Like, that's really the main message of this whole novel, is beware the charismatic religious cult leader, because he was put into place through very calculated machinations by people behind the curtain who are only trying to control you at all. Like, it's their only goal.
Yeah.
You know, it's really funny. Before we started this episode, I put out a little post on our Instagram stories to just kind of ask people what they thought we should discuss. And my friend and author, David Hopkins, said that we should talk about this. And I replied that we should not talk about it because it's just way too controversial for our podcast to be going into things like exposing religion and the military industrial complex.
But that's what the novel's about.
No, that's, man, it's about space shields and giant worms, buddy.
Frank Herbert is such a master because, you know, he gets the whole, okay, you got to have the hero's journey. And he lost sight of that in his later books, and they suffered for me because of that. But he mixed that with this incredible, like, anthropological understanding of humanity. Mm-hmm. And took that framework and put it in this book. It's, yeah. The book wouldn't be the book without that. That's what makes it so beautiful.
Obviously, when I read it as a kid, a lot of that didn't come through for me.
I read it for the first time I just started college. So I was old enough to really start go, oh, shit. I got a sociology degree because of Dune. My whole life is because of Dune. It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
But yes.
Kind of awesome.
Take psychedelics because of Dune. Everything.
Yeah, I think we had to mention psychedelics according to the people responding to the stories. We had to mention that. I figured that would happen at some point. But I'll tell you this. The story that this book really reminded me of was Persepolis by Marjan Satrapi, an Iranian woman writing a kind of an autobiography.
I've heard of it. Did they make a movie out of it?
They did. They did make a movie out of it.
Animated?
Yeah, like an animated movie out of it. It's like a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's really about the cultural revolutions in Iran during the Islamic Revolution. But before it begins, it starts with a real quick summary of what the winning powers of World War II did to the Middle East and how they divided up the Middle East sort of and like laid claims to the territories and set up different types of power systems in those places on purpose so that they would be able to pull the levers in controlling that region without ostensibly controlling the region and like publicly controlling the region, and how that has changed the course of the history in the Middle East dramatically since then. That's sort of the backdrop of those graphic novels. And that's what's happening in Dune. That's the whole plot of Dune, is these people behind the curtains just whispering into certain people's ear and then getting this group of people radicalized so that once they're radicalized, they can be used to do this thing to these people over here in order to control this territory, in order to gain access to this resource. Even if they're not controlling it on the surface, they're controlling it through these back channels, much the way the Bene Gesserits control the action of the Dune universe.
And it's wild. You know, you think about it, it's so reflective of our culture because, like we were saying, it's really a political book about these different factions, these houses, the Bene Gesserit, everyone is trying to get power, and that power all originates from the spice, because the spice is like the oil, and without oil, the world does not work. It just stops.
Right.
And that's what happened. Frank Herbert was like, okay, this is what happens. You cannot travel without the spice. That's it.
He really honestly couldn't have made the metaphor more obvious. It's like it stops you from traveling long distances without it. You can only find it out in the sand. Beware of the locals while you're out there. You know, they'll bomb you. It's not like the metaphor in this story is really hidden between the lines. You know, it's pretty much right there on the surface. I can't imagine any person still listening to this podcast and still thinking this thought, but I get this message to me all the time. All the time somebody's sending me a DM request that says, stick to sci-fi, or some variation of that really, really childish, reductive thought process. You can't do that. You can't separate the politics from the science fiction. You can't separate the meaning from the story. Just because the meaning of the story challenges your worldview, that's really what it comes down to, is you're reacting that way and telling me to stay on what you perceive to be topic.
Sci-fi is like the only genre that can be political, right? As political as it can be, even Star Trek, you know?
Yeah.
But this is what it's based on, because it can be cloaked in a way to where it's not so on the nose. They can explore these themes and say, listen, there's a problem with exploitation of this, this, and this, without being so on the nose that you don't feel like you're being preached at. But it's our job when we're, you know, talking about and critiquing sci-fi to really explore what it's really about.
It's true that we are sharing our interpretations of these things. That is true. You got me there. But these are almost entirely widely shared understandings. You know, we're not just twisting ourselves into knots. We're not performing mental gymnastics to come up with these analogies that are plainly obvious.
No, and you look at 1984, right, by George Orwell. I mean, that is an amazing sci-fi book, but it's a critique of like Stalin and what was happening with these autocratic governments. And so, yes, you have to talk about these things. That's what you do. I love the politics. That's one of the reasons that I love sci-fi.
Right now, I'm actually reading a novel, the Strugatskys, I think I told you about. In our last episode, we talked about that I'm kind of getting into Strugatskys right now. And I read most of The Doomed City, and it's literally a parallel of communism in the world. And it's literally about that. But when releasing this book, these guys lived in the Soviet Union their whole lives. And the Soviet Union was extremely strict about controlling propaganda. And these guys were only able to put out this novel, which you only have to read 10 or 20 pages of it before you realize what it is, that it's a expose of communist Russia and the things that are wrong about it. And the government of Russia still allowed the book to be published anyway. It was a big deal at the time because they were able to use these science fiction analogies in order to post these criticisms. And it's exactly like you say, that is really the point of science fiction, where that, and like we say, to help us define our existence as human beings. You know, those two things, those two things.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the movie a little bit more. We're kind of getting a little bit off track here.
So what other characters? So you thought Christopher Walken was a little iffy. I enjoyed him, but I did think that his performance at times, I was like, So I kind of get where you're coming from that.
What I think happened is that I think he's capable of more range. He's capable of range. I know it. I've seen it.
Oh, yeah.
But I really think Denis Villeneuve came in and was like, no, I want you to do Walken for the Emperor. And it really gave, that's the impression I got from it. I think maybe Javier Bardem's Stilgar got a little bit comic reliefy here and there. You've seen the memes. Everybody's seen the memes, the Stilgar memes.
What are the Stilgar memes? I haven't seen the Stilgar memes.
Oh, man.
I've been avoiding everything. I have not.
It's got like pictures of like the magic trick where you pretend to take the magic trick. I'm doing air quotes here, where you pretend to take your thumb off for like little kids. Well, it's got Paul doing that, and Stilgar's like, oh, Gaim.
I liked him in the movie. I liked
Don't get me wrong. I did like him. And, you know, his point of his character as the faith-led religious leader, that person exists out there. You know what I mean? And I think they painted that character.
Oh, yeah.
They painted that character very well. The faith-led radical leader. You know what I mean? Because he's a big time radical. But those people have to be charismatic.
Absolutely.
And he did that. You know what I mean? He's not hard nosed and angry, not sullen. He's a charismatic leader, which is true of the people in his situation.
Speaking of characters, Lady Jessica, his mom, was on.
Oh, man.
What do you think?
I've been waiting to get there this whole time. She was my favorite actor in the whole movie, bar none. She crushed it. Crushed it. She was so, so good. They built it just like it is in the book. Like, they didn't do anything differently with her character than it is in the book. But they showed how awesome Lady Jessica is. What a boss.
Oh, my gosh. That's what I was saying. She just took control. She was like, this is how this is going to go down.
She's like, you're going to drink the water of life. You know, she straight up tells him.
Yeah.
And it takes him, I don't know how long, it's kind of hard to tell exactly what the timeline looks like in the movie because, you know, it's all in the desert. But she tells him that. And then a long time passes before he comes to terms with the fact that that is going to happen. So she was on it way before. The way they designed her character and the way they designed Bene Gesserit is incredible.
Yeah.
I think they look amazing. The Dune Bene Gesserits are also incredible. I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm just saying that I think Villeneuve's Bene Gesserits look excellent. I think they did a great job with that. When she became the Reverend Mother and got her face tattooed, it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
When they first showed her, I was just like, damn, that is so cool looking.
Yeah, what a design choice. That was so rad. So rad.
For those who didn't know, she has on her face tattooed the Litany Against Fear. That's what's tattooed on her face.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I loved Lady Jessica. I loved the way they looked. I loved the special effects. I never would say something like this, but the CGI in this movie was as good as I've ever seen.
Ever.
There's one scene where one of the Harkonnen ships is bombarding the Fremen temple. And when that scene started, it just cuts right to it launching missiles into the side of the mountain. And in the theater, it was such an experience because it looked so real. The sound editing was so good. It just concussive all around you. I just remember being in the theaters, my jaw dropping and just being like, holy shit. And that happened a bunch of times in this movie, by the way.
I agree. And in the scene you're talking about, I felt the same way. I was like, this is one of the greatest sci-fi scenes I have ever seen. It was so amazing.
It really was.
The battle scenes, and like you said, I'm not a battle scene guy, but it was just breathtaking.
It was
absolutely killed it.
Overall, if I'm giving this movie a score on a scale from 1 to 10, I'm gonna give it a nine. It would get a 10 for me, but I don't really give a movie a 10. That would mean that you couldn't make a better movie, and I don't think that's a really great way to think. You could always improve on everything.
Yeah, my only other complaint about it was I didn't think they pulled off his metamorphosis when he drinks the water of life. Listen, I've done psychedelics. You've done psychedelics. They did not capture the difficulty that you can face. This transformation for him was one in which he became enlightened in the sense that he could bridge time and space with his mind. And I felt like with his visions leading up to it, they were getting to that. But I thought that David Lynch did a much better job of capturing the book and what Paul went through with the Water of Life.
My take on that is that instead of it being a truly, in a physical sense, transformative experience, instead of it giving him superpowers, which is basically what happens in the book, instead of that, to me at least, it sort of seemed like they were playing it to the metaphor where what he really experienced was the ego death that you experience when you level of tripping, when you've tripped enough so that you're able to achieve full ego death, because he kills the Paul that was before him and he becomes this tool.
Well, I agree with you, but I still, because he was bridging time and space, I wanted to see more of that psychedelic element that was in David Lynch's Dune. But I will say what I thought was unbelievable, and I'm glad you brought this up. What I thought they did amazing, what I think really why this movie was so great, was because it was about the character of Paul and his arc and his mother's arc. And they had this diverging, but at the same time, they're so interwoven. But his arc, he took a hard, hard swing towards being evil.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And that was so much more pronounced. He was the hero at the end of David Lynch's.
Yeah, and he was the bad guy at the end of this one. And, you know, he knows in the whole second part of this movie, he knows that if he makes the decision his mother wants him to make and that all of the machinations of the Bene Gesserits and his family and everybody up to this point wants him to make, he knows that it will result in this epic war. And he eventually decides he's going to do it anyway. And he's going to do it because that's his destiny. He's going to do it because he doesn't feel like there's a choice. He's going to do it because he feels like the good he will do will outweigh the evil he will do. Or the good that he will do just for the Fremen will outweigh the evil he does to the rest of the Empire, I guess.
Yeah, to the rest of the Empire. You know, when they defy him, he was like, all right, here we go. He's battling this mythology and this destiny and doesn't want to give in and finally just gives into it. And because of that, he loses her, Chani, in the end.
Makes it seem like Chani has given up on him at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
In the David Lynch movie, he basically explains to Chani that it's an arranged marriage and that he doesn't care about her at all. And he's only doing it to earn the power.
Uh-huh.
In this movie, he never bothers to even tell Chani until he's doing it.
He just tells her, I'll always love you, blah, 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 and then goes and announces his marriage, right?
Yeah.
To me, that turn, when I realized at the very end of the movie, I'm like, oh my God, this is the end of The Godfather when, you know, Michael... closing the doors and they kiss his ring. It's like, oh, he's ascended to power, but that cost of getting that power is you just traded your soul.
Right.
And that took me, I was like, I did not see that coming. I did not see him portraying, you know, but it made sense. It made sense because, you know, if he was trying to avoid, even in the book, if he was trying to avoid all of the bloodshed and the suffering that would be unleashed by him taking power, and he did it anyways, which is what happened, then it wasn't a choice of evil, right? I just didn't see it framed that way,
right?
Even by in the book.
Right.
Did you?
In the book, it's way more subtext.
Yeah.
In that book, the war and everything that could happen if he ascends to power and he becomes the Quetzalcoatl and all of that stuff, that's like a possible future. But in the book and in the subsequent novels after the first Dune novel, it's no longer speculative future. It becomes the reality. He goes through with it and becomes the... I don't even know how to describe a person in that position. He's not a warlord exactly, but he just tries to unify everybody. And
yeah, and he's like, I'm going to unify you under the sword, you know?
Yeah.
You are going to bow.
A fascist dictator.
Yeah. He becomes a fascist dictator, and that I did not see coming. I was like, whoa.
Well, they're talking about potentially making a third movie. It's on the table right now because this movie has been a phenomenal success.
Yeah.
We didn't even talk about that. This movie has been a huge success already. It's only been out for a couple of weeks at this point, and I think it's made like $400 million box office against like $160 million budget. So already a hit. That's a blockbuster.
I hope it makes a billion. I'll go see it. Listen, based on that just zinger at the end, when they were, it was like Paul, the fascist dictator. And on reflection, like we said, it makes sense. Of course, what a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant reading. And to bring that out greater, I thought this was his greatest achievement as a director.
I agree.
Because you can kind of see Paul, it almost looks like physically he's gaining weight. Towards the end, I kept looking at him going, man, he's looking different. And he's becoming, even physically, he's going through. Timothy Chalamet was amazing.
Yeah.
Chalamet was, it was great. And that zinger at the end made me want to see it again. Yeah, he killed it. Oh my gosh.
I'll say I've obviously lived with the David Lynch Dune my whole life. And the cast of the David Lynch Dune was how I saw pretty much all of those characters my whole life. But that's, it just won't be the case anymore, I don't think.
No.
It won't. Chalamet is a better Paul. And I hate to say that, obviously, because...
Yeah, and Brolin's a better Gurney Halleck. And yeah, It was all of them.
Those other actors are phenomenal actors.
Yes.
We're talking Kyle MacLachlan and Patrick Stewart, for Christ's sake. You're talking like really excellent, beloved actors.
How great was Dave Bautista?
He was.
As Raban. Oh my gosh.
I love Bautista. I love following him on Instagram. He's got a great Instagram presence. I think I've talked about this before. When he was in Guardians of the Galaxy, everybody loved him. He's funny. He's really likable and cute and everything. And I thought, good for him. You know, he found a niche where he can go from wrestling to making movies and he doesn't have to really act. And I was like, I appreciate that. I think that's good. I like it when wrestlers become actors. I think it's fun and funny. But then I saw him in Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah.
It blew my mind how good he was in that movie. He's got a small scene, but what he did the best was he played the role really, really understated and really, really subtly. And for me, that was like, wow, you're really good. You've got real acting chops. And in both of the Dune movies, his character is so different because his character is shouting in every single scene. And at first I was like, man, this almost feels like a step backwards for Bautista as an actor. But then I think about it and I'm like, but wait a second, who's he playing? What character is he playing? That character is going to act just like that. You know what I mean? And then there are some scenes at the end of the movie where he's not being the shouting, angry guy. He's, you know, hiding in fear and cowardice because he's no longer in favor with the Duke. I immediately like, oh, there he is. There is the actor. So I'm a big fan of Bautista, man.
Yeah, he killed it. So anyways, wrapping it up, I give the movie a 9.75. I expected Dune 2 to be like Dune 1 in the same type of, you know, same excitement, same all that. It so far eclipsed Dune 1.
Oh, yeah, completely. It makes Dune 1 look like an intro to a novel to me.
Yeah.
It just makes it look like the preface to the story. Okay, one more thing that I promised all the fans that we would talk about is, you saw the movie at theaters, right?
Uh-huh. I did.
Did you get the cup?
You saw this. I did not even know what the cup was until I watched the SNL skit. And I was like, oh my gosh, that is too fun.
We've talked about this a bunch of times, about how movies used to have really fun promotional like tie-ins and toys and that kind of stuff. And they don't really do it as much anymore. But this movie made a pretty good attempt to do it, but they made drink cups and popcorn containers that had what is supposedly supposed to be the mouth of the sandworms of the Shai-Hulud on top. So you kind of like reach through it or put your straw through it or whatever, but they ended up kind of just looking like Satan's fleshlight.
Exactly.
I actually honestly think that they'll probably be collector's items more for that reason than the reason the studio probably wanted them to be collector's
items. I have to get one now because once I saw that SNL skit, I was like, oh, is that real? Were they really selling? Now I'm going to go back and watch the movie and get one of those cups.
If you get one, you know whoever's selling it to you is going to be like, we're going to fuck that cup.
Oh, yeah. I love it. All right. That was such a good one. I can't wait to watch this movie again. I've watched Dune 1 quite a few times and I own it. And so it'll be cool to have this. This one I could see myself watching on repeat many times. And can you imagine trying to watch like 1 and 2 back to back? Oh, it'll be so rad.
It'd be like watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Yeah, yeah. It's like a whole day movie event. My wife actually said she wanted to do that, so I might just do it. You know, we'll see.
So cool, man. So cool.
I mean, this is a good one. We'll have to come back around and think about what we're going to do next. Oh, I just wanted to give a shout out real quick to Poor Things, the film, which I watched the other day, which is a science fiction film in its own sort of way.
We can talk about it because I have it on my list. So
I won't talk about it too much. It's a sort of a science fiction film. Definitely based on, I don't want to tell you too much, but it definitely has elements of Frankenstein and I think elements of Flowers for Algernon as well. But also, it's a wild, wild trip of a movie.
Let's do that one next.
Well, why don't you watch it and decide if we should do it next? Because its sci-fi elements are probably outweighed by some of its other elements.
So I think it sounds okay. Sounds great. I listened to a podcast.
Loved it. I thought it was a fantastic movie, but it is.
Well, the only reason I say it would be a good one is because you're so into Frankenstein. And so Yeah, that's, and I know it's a retelling of that.
Yeah, it's a retelling of Frankenstein in a way. Okay, anyway, we'll figure out what we're going to do next, but we'll do something fun for you guys. Don't worry. Anyway, everybody, thanks for listening to yet another episode of the podcast. And we'll be back again before too long. We're not going to spend our time waiting anymore. We're just going to keep recording.
Keep recording. All right, man. That was awesome. Till next time. Later, brother.
All right, man. Have a good night.
Guys, if you're enjoying the Infinite Worlds podcast, you could definitely check out more Infinite Worlds related stuff by visiting our website, infiniteworldsmagazine.com. There you can subscribe to Infinite Worlds magazine. It's a full color ad-free science fiction magazine featuring stories, comics, and illustrations from creators all over the world. You can also sign up to our mailing list. You can follow us on Instagram at Infinite Worlds Magazine or on Twitter at IW Sci-Fi Mag. Also, you can find Nick the Tooth on Instagram at Nick the Tooth and follow his wild escapades. Theme song was written by Christopher Whitaker, and our podcast is produced by Andrew Alonso.